Welcome to the first Cycle Systems Online podcast for 2022. I hope you all had a good break wherever you are in the world and that you're back doing something with bikes that you love, or at least riding bikes and enjoying it. I'm really excited to bring in a new professional partner of mine and long-term acquaintance. It's Mark Sutton, the editor of Cycling Industry News. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Sean. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
And you probably don't follow us on social media if you didn't know that this year I'm very excited to be presenting the Cycling Industry News podcast. And in fact, we've just recorded the first episode as we speak today. And I'm not going to tell you who it is. You're going to have to wait and see. So check out cyclingindustry.news and also all their social media platforms for the podcast.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that one. It sounds like a very interesting recording.
I do think so. So, Mark, Cycling Industry News is an international bike industry website and magazine. It's something that we're plugged into, and I suspect quite a few of our listeners are as well, although some people may not have heard of it. But before we start talking about your professional life, I'm really interested in your life and your cycling life. If I remember rightly, you're quite big into the BMX. So tell us about how you got started with bikes and how that evolved into a career.
I'm way too old for BMX nowadays. my joints wouldn't put up with some of the stuff that I used to do. So it started on mountain bikes. Way back, I had a Saracen, I think it was an XL hardtail was my first proper bike. But I did have a habit of breaking them because I was essentially using them for what they weren't supposed to. But I was testing the limits of the product, shall we say. That was when I was a lot younger. And as a result of, you know, one too many repair bills, I ended up being given a BMX by a close friend of mine at the time. And I found that a little bit harder to break. So I just sort of stuck with that for a while. And yeah, you rightly point out that that's something that I sort of became. If people asked, oh, what sort of cycling do you do? I'd always say BMX. But I ride mountain bike. I was doing a little bit of BMX a few years ago, but I sort of went back to the woods after a long while of riding skate parks, and that's brought me back to mountain biking a bit more now.
Awesome. So you had this passion for bikes, you're riding bikes. That's very familiar to a lot of people listening. So you work in bike journalism now. Was that your first role in the trade, or like a lot of people, did you start working at a bike shop and go from there?
I really went for the journalism thing more than anything else in the beginning. My start of my working career was juggling a shift at a pub with shadowing a local paper reporter. I spotted an ad for Bike Biz, which at the time was based in my hometown of Hartford, and went from there, really. I spent about 10 years there before jumping ship and starting Cycling Industry News. Funny story with Cycling Industry News, it's a bit of a happy accident. At the time of me looking to leave Bike Biz, I spotted an ad for what I presumed at the time to be a third trade publication, which was Cycle Trade at the time. So there was a brief period there where there were three trade mags, and I assumed the ad was for that. Actually, it was my publisher fishing to start his own at the very same time. So my apologies for cluttering the market for a while, but we are back down to two now. And Duncan Moore, who was the editor of Cycle Trade, actually now writes for us as a really, really clued up freelancer. So funny bit of backstory to Cycling Industry News there.
And it's funny because when I first started working in the bike trade way back when, there was just one mag, and it was a paper mag, and it was really boring. You know, it's like you'd be in between fixing bikes and doing PDIs and picking up all the cool components out of the glass cabinet that you couldn't afford, go, wow, look at this. And, you know, occasionally you'd pick up this magazine and it'd be like, I really don't care what you're writing about. It was so dull. It was so dully written. And it seems like the bike industry media has really transformed since then. So we'll come back to that. But in between some of your professional roles, you traveled the world as well. So I'm really interested about that. How much of it was on two wheels? Where did you go? Where did you ride?
Okay. So, yeah, there was a period of time, probably, I think it was about 3 years ago now, where I took what you'd guess, I guess you'd call it a sabbatical. But really it was just something that had been in the planning for years, but these things cost money. So we were saving for a long, long time. And in the end, we were away for about 9 months. Luckily my publisher, was very kind and sort of agreed to, have me back. I was with the good fortune that Jonathan Harker followed me from Bikebiz, to the same publisher. So he was sort of standing custodian while I was away. But in the 9 months, we went through Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, Burma. Where else did we go? And Sri Lanka, I think, might have been the other. But in lots of little islands as well. So that was, should we call it, the highlight of my life. And then COVID swiftly followed as soon as we landed. So we timed it brilliantly. I came back from that with a lot more energy than I've ever really sort of had in my life. So I think it was good for the soul.
Yeah, certainly sounds like it. And were there any cycling highlights on the trip?
On one of the final days of the traveling stint, I was in Bali. There was a bike park that was being developed out there. And I'd been a little while. I actually at the start of the trip, rode in Rotorua, where some of the big mountain bike events are. So that was the first stint. That was kind of the polar opposite of the Bali experience. The Bali experience was just tearing through some sort of jungle with some tracks they'd cut out, and then all of a sudden, I find they built their own sort of version of what's in Rotorua, right at the bottom of the run in Bali, which was this huge wooden step up, which I didn't actually hit that. It was that big. Those were the two major riding experiences. One of my favorites, though, I think it doesn't necessarily have to be the enthusiast thing. We got around by bike in various countries, and one that will stick with me forever was riding beach cruisers along Byron Bay Beach in Australia. Obviously that wasn't shredding in the same way that it might have been in Bali or New Zealand, but it was just a really nice memory just to cruise along the beaches on those sort of bikes.
Yeah, no, certainly. I've got quite nice memories of being completely jet-lagged on Waiheke Island in New Zealand when we first went there, riding this electric fat bike along the beach while hallucinating with the jet lag. Really, it was quite an experience. We got photographic evidence of that as well.
I did quite enjoy being on another form of two wheels. We pretty much got around Asia on mopeds and bicycles. But we did do in the northern part of Vietnam something called the Hajang Loop, which I would fully recommend, once the borders get a bit more open, travel opens up a bit more, I'd recommend that. The scenery up there right near the border of China is just incredible.
Awesome. Well, here's to the days when we can all do that. So yeah. There's been all sorts of jokes about the bike industry in the past. So I remember, I forget the guy's name, he's now in the Bicycle Association, I'm sure you'll know the guy's name, came in from ICI into, I think it was Raleigh at the time, and said, God, the bike industry is like Steptoe and Son.
Oh, yeah.
It's a pretty famous quote, and a lot of people in the bike industry will get that. And also, there was the old joke that if you want a bike shop and £1 million, start with £2 million. So there's all of this romantic, nose pressed up at the window of the bike shop, looking at your dream bike that many people can relate to. And for working in the industry, there's all sorts of these, sometimes frustrations, but actually sometimes I think it's quite affectionate and we kind of quite like it. Errols, where's the bottom bracket tool? There's something nice about it rather than it being completely faceless and corporate all the time. You know, I think a lot of us go into the bike trade because we don't want to be a corporate drone necessarily. But from when you've come into bike industry media to now, how much have you seen that change and how has it changed?
Yeah, that's something we're writing about more and more. I've never seen the amount of outsider cash coming into the bike industry as we seem to be getting lately. It won't have escaped any of our readers' attention, certainly, that the figures quoted, I don't know, take Rad Power Bikes in America, north of $100 million investment, just proper money really getting behind some of these companies. And I did conduct an interview with one of the he branded himself the bike banker, who sort of navigated the Canyon deal.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating just to sort of hear the criteria that these investors are looking at. It is primarily electric bikes.
Yeah.
It's primarily things with a fairly tight supply chain. And the things drawn as well are, you know, the health and well-being angle, the technology angle, lots of these things. It's really turning heads in the investment world by the looks of it. And, you know, between the European cycling industries, Europe, and the Bicycle Association here, I can see they're doing investment sort of seminars and advisories for businesses that are looking to navigate this. And, you know, there's bike businesses taking over bike businesses as well. It's the Ponder Rail thing, which has just completed. When headlines like that break, it does stop you in your tracks a bit. And as you say, it feels like a different era for the bike industry all of a sudden, because cash wasn't really something that we were known for.
Yes, certainly. However, expertise and industry sector knowledge is. And one thing I've noticed is sometimes you'll get people coming into the bike industry. I don't know if arrogance is the right word, but certainly ignorance and awareness of what's necessary. So the first kind of real big money bike thing that I was ever even slightly involved with, you know, from working as a shop mechanic on very much minimum wage to setting up cycle systems in 2007. And we were actually asked by a company called City Bike to be the mechanical arm of a bid for the big, what eventually are erroneously called Boris bikes, these TFL hire bikes. So we were involved in creating and curating a bid to run this multi-million pound contract for Greater London for the bike share scheme, which of course they're now ubiquitous across the world. And it was really fascinating to see that, because there were so many people bidding for it from existing bike hire companies in London, right through to people like Circa, who eventually won it. And of course, there was all sorts of eyebrows raised, because people that worked for TFL then ended up working for Circa. And you wonder how these deals are done, but we'll never know. Mm-hmm. But of course, Circa were outside the bike industry. No one from the bike industry got a sniff at it. And everyone they used initially was from outside the bike industry. So they used these awful bikes from Canada, which were pretty poor. What's been quite nice is after a few years of these bikes performing reasonably badly, they've turned to Pashley. And in fact, Pashley were going to be the bike supplier for this company, City Bike. So I knew this particular bike very, very well. Had some great meetings down at the stunning Pashley factory with Adrian and co. So it looked like the bike industry, the quality bike industry, was bypassed for a known public sector provider, aka Serco, and then bought in when the, you know, it was realized they were necessary. And we certainly see that with training of mechanics as well. So the big contracts like the Mac Lease and the bike hire and stuff, they'll often think, what's the cheapest way we can fix the bikes? And one company I won't name, when we contacted them, they'd won a massive contract, and they said, hey, do you want to train any staff, any mechanics? And they said, oh, no, we're just going to use our motor mechanic apprentices because it's just a bike.
Right. Yeah.
And that went as well as could be expected. And that policy changed as well. So as we move forward, have you noticed or do you think that the existing bike industry could just be left behind by the new money? Or do you think it will be integrated or have to be integrated into what's happening?
Yeah, this again is quite a fascinating subject. I think I'll refer back to last year. The only time I left the country last year wasn't quite so glamorous. I went out to Eurobike and then subsequently the IAA Mobility Show, which, you know, for the first time has invited in bikes. Previously, that would be known as one of the German car industry shows. And so that's, you know, that's blurring these lines between mobility and obviously there's cash coming from either side. I keep a little bit of an eye on this and have been for a few years actually, the car industry's interest in bikes. Now previously, you know, a lot of the bikes bearing car brands names would have been made within the bike industry, but increasingly I think the automotive side are actually investing themselves in the expertise to take this forward. You will have seen the BMW electric bike, for example, and there's new ones from Mercedes. There's all sorts of
Harley Davidson. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, Harley. Pretty much all of them have got something going on. And in the past, I think there was, you know, a bit of a joke as to, oh, the car industry will never get round, you know, the geometries that make a bike ride well, and it was never really taken too seriously. But I think we're at a time now where we perhaps have to start considering that we've got some very well-financed competition who have a lot of influence, and that influence might, you know, serve us well in if the car industry decides, okay, we need to look at other mobility options, well then cycle lanes will get built and in theory it will benefit everyone. But BMW's remark when they released their electric bike, I can't remember it verbatim, but it was essentially, we're not super keen on the current electric bike regulation. We might, you know, see what we can do, which was a really bold remark to make. But of course, a company of that size they've got the power to and influence to upset something that perhaps the bike industry might want to keep on a steady trajectory, given that it's keeping a lot of businesses in good health at the moment. So yeah, that will lead to other discussions. Money aside, it will, you know, the legislation influence that other industries might have on the future of our industry is definitely one to watch.
Yep, certainly. And of course, insert joke about BMW drivers right here. It's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of people, like we did a podcast recently with Mark Haylett, who trains Bosch mechanics in the UK. And for a lot of people, the current regulations, both on e-scooters and e-bikes, seem a bit preposterous. You know, like you hire an electric scooter, we've got them here in Bern in Switzerland, and they're an awesome way for ratting around the town, and you get into certain areas in the old down here and they go to walking pace. But of course, if you were to drive your BMW convertible down the road in exactly the same place, there's no motor limiter going on there. But yeah, it'd be good to see if the motor industry, with its much greater lobbying power, is actually able to open up things such as the speed restrictions on e-bikes, which a lot of people think are a bit too OTT.
The design actually is fascinating. I think that, and then I don't think they're alone in this dual motor concept. At first, when Canyon came forward with the Velomobile concept, which I know that, you know, in the background there, they weren't sure was going to make to production, but it was an idea nonetheless. It's a dual motor thing, one with a standard electric bike regulation motor, and then another which I think they were targeting like 50 mile an hour with it. It would be used on the roads. That, you know, the geofencing and the GPS would determine whether you're on a bike path or the road. and the motors would switch in sync with that, which is fascinating in technology terms. The conversation around how we whether the conditions are right and the legislation is another conversation entirely, but in technology terms it kind of shows what can be done.
And of course the motor will cut out if your social credit system goes down a certain amount because you liked the wrong Facebook post that morning.
Could be.
Yeah, it could be coming. So one of the things I really like about cycling industry news is you're really big on the data. So you're not just kind of going down your local bike shop and chatting to Bob. You are really finding out what's happening in the industry precisely. And one of the things you've mentioned to me is that there's a staggering amount of new businesses in the bike industry. I'm really interested, is that worldwide? Is it European, North American? Is it just UK?
Our data is based on UK bike shop feedback, which I'm incredibly grateful for. We started out 5 years ago trying to do this, and initially it was pretty much just an effort to inform our editorial, which, you know, it continues to do. One of the things from this year's data is, just having a quick look at it, 14% of shops are less than, shops and workshops that is, are less than 2 years old. So we have got a bit of young blood in the market, and then there's some long established as well, which seems to be about a quarter of the market are over 20 years old. So this is the sort of just a snippet from the data, like you say, we're gathering just to better understand the flow in and out of the market.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
And one of the things I'm really fascinated about, and we're actually going to get into this in great detail in the Cycling Industry News podcast with people who know more about this than I do, is obviously if you look back not that far, I mean, certainly here in the UK, we had absolute giants like Raleigh, you know, churning out bikes and exporting them all around the world. All over Europe, North America, there were all these homegrown bike brands, you know, even till fairly recently, Cannondale and Trek were actually made in the USA. Either made in the USA, Trek carbon road frame. It's not that old. And famously, of course, production is mostly in the Far East now for all sorts of reasons. And with the pandemic and with the cost of shipping containers being more than the value of the containers and yada, yada, that's just got locked, completely locked and blocked. And we have got tools that we need, for example, for servicing suspension, the lead time is 2024 for these tools. And the CEO of SRAM was on the Nerd Alert podcast recently, one of my favorite podcasts, with James Wang, who's one of my heroes, tech heroes, you know. And this guy, I forget his name, it's not Standay anymore, it's someone new. And he just came across as this absolute corporate drone to me, not to James, we had disagree on it. But he seemed to think it was great because it was good for SRAM. And he had no empathy or seemingly understanding for the wider industry. If we can't buy their stuff, it's not a good thing, essentially. So with all of this happening in the bike industry, do you think companies like Hope are going to really thrive, who produce everything in the UK? And we're noticing, say, Bianchi are investing, is it 40 million euros? In producing a new factory to produce carbon frames in Italy. Do you think we're going to see this more and more?
Yeah, there's definitely a trend of it. I know that, you know, countries like Portugal and Poland in the last few years have really developed a manufacturing base for a lot of things. The trend, I think if you were to type the word reshoring into the search bar on our site, it would probably bring up more articles in the past year than it has done in the prior five. The pandemic certainly has shaken things up and given people pause for thought. I spoke to very briefly to Ian Walker, I think he's a psychology professor, and he said that the pandemic has given the world a chance to sort of stop and reassess. Whereas before that, we were, you know, week in, week out routine. We didn't really have a chance to stop and think about, you know, what is the best way forward. But now I think coming out the other side of it, there will be a lot of companies really assessing where they do produce things and the pros and cons, not just revolving around cost as well.
And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, because obviously emotionally, if you're in the US, for example, you're probably going to feel pretty good about a bike built in the US. And if you're in the UK, but wow, this was built in England, fantastic. I love Hope Components for that. It's lovely to have a Hope component and know it was built in Lancashire and yada, yada. Whereas if you're buying something from the other side of the world, especially with pretty dodgy labor conditions in a lot of these countries, horrific political situations sometimes, and basically modern slavery within a lot of the modern globalized capitalist system, it's nice to know that you've basically bought an ethical product, isn't it? And for me, I would happily pay more if needed, you know, to have a kind of fair trade stamp or something equivalent on that. But if there is lots and lots of reshoring throughout a lot of the places where people are buying bikes, of course, lots of people buy bikes in China, so sorry to be giving it the Western emphasis, but how do you think it's going to affect the consumer?
Just going back there, there are studies that do tend to show what you were saying about you know, sustainability, and you know, if a company can show that it's got good ethical work and practices, particularly the younger generations have actually been shown to be willing to spend more money on products generated in this way, and can demonstrate as well. I think one of the conversations coming in at the moment is greenwashing, and that's something we have to keep an eye on. Just you know, I don't think the bike industry will. We're probably seen as a green industry, whether that's fair or not. But I think now is the time we've got to really demonstrate that, if that is indeed the case. But yeah, consumers, I think, definitely are warming to that message. So for brands that are genuine, I think that's a real win and a chance to gain some new customers.
In terms of the industry themselves, obviously we get staff from bike shops who come to us for bike mechanic training. I'll often be speaking to shop managers and shop owners, but often they're busy, we're busy, and we're just talking about staff training. So I'm not particularly tuned in to the bike industry's main concerns necessarily. So from the people you speak to and from cycling industry chats on Facebook, which I'd recommend people join, what are the sort of one concerns you're hearing from people, and what are people in the bike industry getting excited about?
I guess at the moment the concern is the fluctuation of available stock. Like you rightly pointed out, some lead times are stretching years. There's been some beneficiaries of that as well. You know, I've spoken to your Sunrace Sturmey Archers and Gates Belt Drives, that sort of thing. They've benefited from this period of you know, Shimano has such a dominance, and the SRAM to a lesser degree as well. So it's that's been one of the interesting things out of this, is that there's other brands that are taking advantage or been given the chance actually to show their worth, and I think that's, with any luck, that might ever so slightly dent Shimano's dominance, and just, you know, just allow the market to breathe a bit. But supply is probably still the main concern, although I think some of the bikes are starting to filter through now. We may even be in the state where some orders are being cancelled, and that then makes those bikes available to others that weren't so lucky the first time around on the orders. It's really interesting, isn't it, at the moment. The last couple of years, a few brands have withdrawn from the model year so strictly, CSG to name one. So the supply conundrum is the main challenge at the moment, and hopefully that begins to settle. In terms of opportunity, apart from everyone having their head down at the moment, I think it's still got to be the electric bike. Seems to be, within our data, over the years I've tracked what would you say is your store or workshop speciality, and generally it's been leisure cycling, road cycling, mountain biking, there was a slightly less, but electric bikes has just come up through the ranks on that year after year, to the point where it's pretty much on par with the amount of stores that say they're a mountain bike specialist now would say they're an electric bike specialist.
Yeah, now hasn't it been fascinating, to see that, like if we look in the UK anyway, well, we're both familiar with, if you look back to say the big national cycle shows at Earl's Court, in London back in sort of 2006, 2007, 2008, and the electric bike people would be literally the lunatic fringe. They'd be the guys with 3-day-old egg in their beards, and everyone else ignoring it and looking at the latest mountain bikes, at the time. Whereas now it does seem like the e-bike is the safest bet, purely because of all the people who would never ride a bike for whatever reason, who will ride an e-bike. The market seems to be exponential.
Yeah, that's something that I've been pitching on the side to Cycling Electric magazine, and we've been exploring pretty much every use case for the electric bike, and that's everything from the personal use of the cargo bike, but actually also the quite astonishing business use. You've now got DHL and ASDA are trialing their use. I think that's indicative of a real change in inner city deliveries and mobility, for names like that to be actually committing. We wouldn't have seen that years ago. That's like you say, there's been a change. But yeah, for me, the best thing about it is it's pulling in people that have perhaps been on the fence about cycling. They might cycle once in a while, but now they sling a leg over on an electric bike, and it ups the amount of times they're using it, and steadily they'll start to consider the use cases for it. Whether it's pulling them out of the car once a week or just adding to the leisure. I think it's become a real tool to let people explore the outdoors, to do longer journeys, and just to have more energy. For me, I did nearly end up buying my first electric bike not so long ago, and I will make a full admission. I'm a fairly lazy cyclist. I'm a mountain biker mostly, but when I am cycling A to B, probably the first couple of miles when my legs are getting warmed up, that's the bit where I'm like, I'm nearly enjoying this. And then for sort of 4 or 5 miles in, I'm like, okay, yeah, no, I'm warmed up now. I'm happy. I'm cadence is good and everything. But that first couple of miles, my legs hate me. So the electric bike for me, as a means of doing my journey to work, it's about 13 miles there and then obviously back. So I'm not going to cycle that every day. I'm realistic about that. So, but on the electric bike, it is going to up the amount of time to make that journey.
Yeah, I mean, I can personally relate to that. I'm sure a lot of listeners can. When I lived in Devon, I had a similar size commute, and that was in Devon. So I'd be either riding up or down, 10 to 20% hills through these little lanes in order to get to work. And to be perfectly honest, that's something you need a degree of fitness for and commitment, to do. Yeah. And I used to cycle through these little villages, which are often full of, quite middle-class commuters now, towny types who've moved out to the country. And I'd be riding through these little villages thinking, not many of these people I'm seeing who are driving off to work in Exeter or something would take a bike. Okay, they're not going to put on Lycra and get a road bike and cycle in the rain, in the dark, up a 20% gravel hill, But they do it on an e-bike. And I bet if they did it once, they'd love it so much, that would be it. Mm. They'd be on it. So certainly, it's really exciting to see. It's sometimes a bit depressing when you see politicians and such getting excited about flying taxis and you know, you heard the podcast we did with Carlton Reed about COP26, and you had a great article on cyclingindustry.news about COP26, where cycling just wasn't on the agenda. Even e-bikes weren't. Politicians like big shiny things, don't they? Forever. I was watching World War II in colour last night on Netflix about the North Atlantic battle. And this historian said, yeah, Hitler liked big shiny things because he liked big shiny things. And that's why he built the Bismarck, not more U-boats. And of course, lost in the war. And it seems the same. You know, politicians just like the shiny, exciting flying taxis or electric cars. But it seems that people are voting with their feet and their bottoms. And certainly the electric cargo bikes are amazing because cycle systems started as mobile mechanics. And we started with these big Long John freight bikes in London, and they were horrific to ride. The big old steel early 20th design, you know, full of tools and spares. It was quite a skill to be, and you needed a lot of fitness just to get these things around London, which is pretty flat. So the modern, like, electric Larry versus Harry and such freight bikes are just amazing.
Yeah, and they're solving a problem, which is congestion, which the electric car isn't going to solve. Certainly, you might have thought that they would begin to design these things to be at least a little bit smaller, so they're applicable. No, I keep seeing these bigger and bigger SUVs, particularly the ones being launched in America, albeit there's a bit more space there. But they don't seem to be getting much smaller. However, when I was at the IAA Mobility Show there were some quirky, from the likes of Micro, there were essentially single or dual person micro cars, which I think were electric. The door was actually on the very front of the car, which was unusual, but, you know, it solved the problem of you could park it at a lot more places. It took up a lot less space. It was essentially the size of one of the larger cargo bikes. That's that blurred line of mobility again, I think. Perhaps elements of the car industry have begun to acknowledge that the conversation really is about efficient use of space, not necessarily whether you ride a bike or drive a car. It's it's been pointed out that cars are stationary for 23 hours of the day. When you're driving them, generally you're carrying around a sofa and two armchairs, and only one of those chairs is full. And you might look over at the cycle lane and think, oh, well, that's empty. That's not a good use of space. But that's because all the cyclists aren't stuck in the traffic, and you are. I think the conversation going forward has to really be about efficient use of space. I think it's a massive flaw with the electric car thing, among other things, which bug me. But I don't think I'll be buying one anytime soon, mostly because I can't afford one.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I wanted to ask you a couple of things before we wrap up. And firstly was a personal thing. So with, you know, hopefully COVID restrictions ending after everyone's had it, you know, most of us have had it now. Have you got any dream locations where you want to go on holiday to either a new or explore again?
Wow, that's a big question. This is that thing I said I wouldn't do before the podcast and take a big long pause where I think about something. we had in mind to hire a motorhome and do parts of the wild America, you know, the wilderness of Montana. I did do a couple of days off the back of an interbike 1 year through Utah and Arizona, right along that border, and there's a cluster of things. From Zion National Park through to Antelope Canyon and that sort of area. I touched on very lightly a few days, pretty much camped out in one of these big American SUVs. Turns out it gets quite cold in the desert at night. we worked that one out on the way through Monument Valley, where we tried to catch the sunrise, and we in the Walmart out there, luckily we grabbed a American football, and that was one of the things we fond memories of traveling. Tossed that around as the sunrise came up over Monument Valley. That I've got fond memories of that part of the world, but I realize how much of it is unexplored. So possibly that would be the next thing, maybe 2 weeks in a motorhome.
Amazing, sounds good. And also for anyone listening, because I think there's probably quite a few listeners to this podcast who are maybe, you know, they're going to come on a course with us or with someone else. They're interested in getting into the bike industry because lots and lots of our students in the last couple of years, especially, have been outside the industry and said, you know what, I'm checking my job or I've just got laid off. I'm going to set up a cycle business. So if someone wanted to do that and they came onto cyclingindustry.news, what would they find that to be of use to them?
If they go on there in perhaps a month or two's time, they will find a new article on that because that's being written at the moment. We have an old article on that can be searched, you know, what about opening a bike shop. And essentially, I just pulled a bunch of opinion from people who've already done it. Check back on that one.
Sounds good. Okay, yeah. Brilliant. So, yeah, definitely check that out. So cyclingindustry.news, you've got Cycling Industry Chat on Facebook. And of course, guys, you can find us at Dial Up Your Cycle Tech Skills on Facebook as well. So give us all of your opinions and feedback and questions and such. But for now, Mark Sussent, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll catch up again soon.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.